I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. A succession of federal and state laws have been enacted to impose tougher penalties on perpetrators of hate crimes, criminal acts that target victims because of their race, religion, gender, or ethnicity. But as the frequency of hate crimes has increased across the country in recent years, some lawmakers and civil liberties activists have questioned whether hate crime laws are an effective response to acts of bigotry. Today, we'll talk with Faizan Syed, the executive director of the Missouri chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, and Frederick Lawrence, a civil rights scholar and visiting professor at the Yale Law School. It's terrible but legal to be a racist. When bigotry is behind a crime, what's the best way to prosecute the criminal? Midday starts right after the news. And indeed, it is midday, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you had a nice weekend. And for you moms out there, I hope you had a nice Mother's Day. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you are with us this afternoon. There has been an unsettling increase in the number of reported hate crimes in the United States in recent months. But there is certainly nothing new about bigots committing crimes. The mob lynchings that terrorized African Americans after the Civil War continued well into the 20th century. Bias against homosexuals and transgender individuals has for years resulted in violent attacks. American churches, synagogues, and mosques have been favored targets of vandals, arsonists, and sometimes murderers. Since the late 1960s, and notably since the Al-Qaeda terror attacks on the U.S. on 9/11, American lawmakers and law enforcement agencies have been responding to the persistent scourge of hate crimes with a spate of laws designed to single out these violent, targeted acts of malice for special prosecution. There are stiffer prison penalties for those who are convicted of a bias crime. But have those laws been effective? Have they helped or have they even hindered the prosecution of some crimes? Have they helped make the likely targets of hate crime any safer? Are hate crime laws necessary? Are they constitutional? Can we punish people for what they think in addition to what they do? Lots to talk about this afternoon. My guests for this hour, Faizan Syed is the executive director of the Missouri chapter of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. That's a grassroots civil rights and advocacy group that works to promote a positive image of Islam and Muslims in America. Mr. Syed joins us on the line from his office in St. Louis. Welcome to the show. Mr. Syed, can you hear me? All right.
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you. Sorry, I cut out for a little bit.
Glad you're there. And joining us by phone from New York is Frederick Lawrence, a civil rights scholar and the CEO of the Phi Beta Kappa Society. He's the author of a book called Punishing Hate, Bias Crimes Under American Law. In the 1980s, Mr. Lawrence served as the chief of the Civil Rights Unit in the office of the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, working under then U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani. Mr. Lawrence has also served as dean of the George Washington University Law School and as president of Brandeis University. He's currently a senior research scholar and visiting professor of law at the Yale Law School. Mr. Lawrence, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
So, Mr. Lawrence, let me begin with you. Hate crime legislation began coming onto the scene both at the federal and state level in the 1960s, I guess in part as a response to the scourge of lynchings and whatnot that took place in our country for decades between the late 1880s and the mid-1960s. More than 3,400 African Americans were lynched in the United States. So that's sort of where they grew out of, if I understand that correctly. But tell me what the intent of this legislation, and I know it differs slightly from state to state, but what's the intent behind laws specifically identifying hate crimes?
Generally, all hate crime laws across the states and even federal hate crime laws recognize that certain kinds of crimes have a greater harm than others, and when they do, that should be recognized in the way in which we identify them and the way in which we punish them. So it was a recognition in most of the states, and as I say, in the federal government as well, that when crimes are committed with bias motivation, and that means at least race and religion, religion and ethnicity. In some jurisdictions, it means gender and sexual orientation and sexual identity as well, that the harm that is done to the individual is deeper and more profound because the individual is targeted not just for who he is or where he was, but what he is. And there's a kind of spirit murdering that happens. On top of that, it hits the community in a particularly dangerous way so that you see these social fissure lines come apart at the seams. And you see in one of these instances of racially motivated violence or religiously motivated violence, the target community feels victimized and the entire society understands it as hitting one of these social split lines. So on each of those levels, individual, group, and national, it is a deeper kind of harm, and that's what these laws recognize.
And Faizan Syed, you're in St. Louis with the Missouri chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. President Obama in 2009 signed what was dubbed the Matthew Shepard Hate Crime Act. What's your take on the effectiveness of that law in these last 8 years? We seem to have lost Mr. Syed again, and we'll try to get back to him in a second. But Mr. Lawrence, if I could turn again to you, what does a prosecutor have to prove in order for a crime to be designated as a hate crime?
It's one of two things, depending on the specific statute in the state. One would be actual bias animus, that the act was done out of hatred for this individual as a member of that group. So racial animus and a racially motivated violence case would be the classic example. The other that some states have gone with is what's called discriminatory selection, meaning that this person was identified as a victim because of that person's membership in the group. Needn't necessarily be one of animus or hatred, but of discrimination. And I will say, Tom, one of the reasons I tend to use the term bias crime and not hate crime is that hate can mean lots of different things. Sometimes people hate each other and it has nothing to do with bias or discrimination. So when we talk about hate crimes the way we are today, we really mean bias crimes, meaning it's a criminal manifestation of bigotry.
All right. And Mr. Syed, I think we have you back. Is that right? Can you hear me? Not yet. We were told that he was there, but we can't seem to find him. Well, Mr. Lawrence, again, let me go back to you. If a person then exhibits bias but not hate, is there a distinction? In other words, if I'm going to kill someone and in the act of killing that person, I say, you're a jerk, you smell bad, you're ugly, you're a rotten speller, that's
right.
One thing. But if I say, if I call that person the N-word or a Jew boy or Islamic terrorist or something, that's another thing. Is that a distinction that the laws make?
It is a distinction, and that's because the law is concerned not just with a particular ideology or view that a person has, but does it have a social context? So it's been very interesting to watch over the 80s and 90s as bias crime laws expanded to include groups that they hadn't before. If you go back to the discussion in the 1970s and 1980s, everybody would have recognized that race and religion and ethnicity and most would have said national origin are characteristics. But not all would have said sexual orientation, and not all would have said gender. And part of the recognition of these groups and the role they play in society has been to see how they are become part and parcel of bias crime laws. And when you asked me before about what a prosecutor has to prove, that motivation has to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And this is the answer that I give to people who are concerned that if somebody is upset with someone else, that they can claim it was a bias crime. In fact, these are very difficult crimes to prove. And most prosecutors, if they don't think they can prove the bias crime, will choose the lesser included offense of the assault or the vandalism or the murder, whatever the crime happens to be, and not take on that additional burden of proving the bias motivation. The truth is that in some cases it's hard to prove bias motivation, but in other cases it's actually quite straightforward. We started by talking about lynchings, where it's very clear that the victim is selected solely on the basis of the victim's race. It's very clear that there's animus towards African Americans, that it was at the heart of lynching. And it's very clear the message they were trying to send. So in those cases, bias motivation would, in fact, not be difficult to prove.
And if a prosecutor chooses to prove bias motivation, what does she get for that? Is it simply a matter of extended penalties, or is there anything else?
Well, it is extended penalties, but I think we should say what we mean by that. We have a criminal justice system, and not just the United States. This is Western societies generally, and many outside of the West, where the length of the sentence is the way in which we make our value judgment as a people that something worse has happened. I mean, there's a reason that every civilized society punishes murder worse than arson, and arson worse than most other forms of vandalism, and vandalism with a deadly weapon more than vandalism without a deadly weapon, because we make a kind of judgment that there's a hierarchy of harms, and one of the ways in which you recognize that is the severity of the sentence. We do it in part because we want to deter the actor. That's called deterrence theory. But we also do it because we think the actor is blameworthy, and the blame is partially a function of the damage that was caused or intended to be caused.
Frederick Lawrence is a civil rights scholar and former federal prosecutor. He's currently a senior research scholar and visiting professor of law at the Yale Law School. It's midday. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. We're hoping now to be joined by Faizan Syed, who is the executive director of the Missouri chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Mr. Syed, I apologize for our technical difficulties.
Oh, no, it's quite all right.
And tell me, as I mentioned earlier, President Obama signed what's known as the Matthew Shepard Act in 2009. From your point of view and your perspective, working to improve perspectives and images of Muslim Americans here, how do you assess the effectiveness and the efficacy of the hate crime legislation at the federal level that's now been in place for about 8 years?
Well, from our perspective, we do greatly support this type of hate crime legislation at the federal level and really at all levels. As was previously stated, hate crimes not only impact the individual, but they also impact the entire community and the society. At our local chapter, we are able to utilize this hate crime legislation in order to reinvigorate and make sure that the seriousness of the crime is addressed within the society. An example I can give is about a year ago, a family named Rabia Ayub, they actually had a man who pulled a gun on him, his wife, and his three children while they were looking for a new home. Initially, when we spoke with the county prosecutor, Bob McCullough, the same Bob McCullough who's involved in the Mike Brown shooting here in Ferguson, initially, he was hesitant to charge it as a hate crime because it is so difficult to actually prove hate crimes within the state of Missouri. But, of course, from our perspective and from the leadership perspective, from imams and the larger Muslim community, they felt that this was important that he take that extra step to do this, even though it would be more difficult because the gravity of the crime was not only against Rabia and his family, it was against all American Muslims. Personally speaking, I met many Muslim families after that incident happened who themselves were afraid, who took their children out of school because they thought something might happen to them. So it is important that these pieces of legislation do exist because it allows the community to make sure that the seriousness of the crime is addressed.
And that crime, of course, is a heinous act. It's terrible. And the crime itself, even if it weren't prosecuted as a hate crime, of course, was prosecuted as the fundamental crime. So we're not allowed to murder people in the United States. But we are allowed under the First Amendment, are we not, Mr. Syed, to think malicious thoughts. And we are allowed, as repugnant as it may be, to be racist and to be anti-Muslim or anti-Jewish or anti-Christian or anti-anything. I mean, what about the fact that the First Amendment does guarantee us freedom of speech while at the same time criminal statutes do not permit us to act in a way that is violent or hurtful towards people that we may hate?
That's a great point. So, of course, the First Amendment does allow all types of speech, including hate speech. And the differences between speech or thoughts versus actions is what's known between the difference of a hate incident versus a hate crime. And hate incident can be, you know, any type of action that's, you know, done that was motivated by bias against the victim's race, religion, ethnicity, national origin, so on. But, of course, that can be speech or it can be disrespectful commentary or behavior, but which itself is not illegal. To have bad thoughts or to say things is not itself illegal. The difference between the hate incident and the hate crime is when that crime actually, the perpetrator commits violence against a person or a property, or if that place a potential victim in reasonable fear of physical injury. So, of course, there's a distinction between having bad thoughts and then acting on those bad thoughts. And that's really where we want to draw that line. So when a person goes from having bad thoughts about Muslims, Jews, or you know, people who are LGBTQ, and then crosses the line to then attacking a house of worship or targeting somebody, then that offense should be dealt with in the seriousness that it deserves.
We're going to take a little break, but we will come back with more with Faizan Syed. He's the executive director of the Missouri chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, and Frederick Lawrence. He's a civil rights scholar and a former federal prosecutor in New York. He's currently a senior research scholar and visiting professor of law at the Yale Law School. We will take a short break now. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion of bias crime legislation, whether it's been an effective way to fight bias-motivated crimes in this country. So what do you think? Might bias crime laws actually work against some of the victimized groups that they were designed to protect? There are folks who think that that's the case. We invite you to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, which we hope you'll do, at Midday Tom Hall. Stick around. We will be back in a minute.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation with Ryan White. He's the director of a new Netflix documentary called The Keepers. It's a 7-part documentary, and it's going to be released Friday. It focuses on sexual abuse in the 1960s and 70s at Archbishop Keough High School here in Baltimore and the unsolved 1969 disappearance and death of Sister Catherine Ann Sesnick, an English teacher at the school. We're also going to talk with Gemma Hoskins. She's one of a group of Keough alums who have spent decades looking for the truth behind their teacher's death. So the story behind the new Netflix documentary, The Keepers, coming up tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're exploring this question. Are bias crime laws the best way to prevent and prosecute criminal acts motivated by bigotry? Could categorizing certain acts as bias crimes actually make it harder to prosecute them? And could that put vulnerable target groups at even greater risk? You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. Follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Joining us by phone from New York this afternoon is Frederick Lawrence. He's a civil rights scholar, and in the 1980s, he served as the chief of the civil rights unit in the office of the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. He was working under then U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani. He's also served as the dean of the George Washington University Law School and the president of Brandeis University. He's currently a senior research scholar and visiting professor of law at the Yale Law School. Faizan Syed joins us from St. Louis. He's the executive director of the Missouri chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. They're a grassroots civil rights and advocacy group that works to promote a positive image of Islam and Muslims in America. And we are joined now by Robert West. He is the civil rights staff attorney for the Council on American Islamic Relations, who also joins us today from St. Louis. Mr. West, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your take on the efficacy of the hate crime legislation that exists in all but 5 states at the state level and then on the national level? First of all, there are those who say that there's no evidence whatsoever that says that these are a deterrent to people committing crimes motivated by bigotry. What's your understanding of the data and your hunch as an attorney?
My understanding of the data is pretty much in agreement with that sense that it isn't necessarily a deterrent. I think that you can actually broaden that entire line of thinking to, I mean, you know, a lot of crimes. When people commit crimes, I think generally speaking, and this is kind of more transitioning into the second part, my hunch as an attorney, I think when people commit crimes, generally speaking, you know, in the moment of them committing it, or even in the moment of them planning it, you know, obviously, what, you know, getting caught and being, you know, held accountable for the crime doesn't necessarily enter the calculus. I think if it would, you know, people wouldn't commit the crimes.
And Mr. Lawrence, this is Frederick Lawrence, who's a senior research scholar at the Yale Law School. Explain to us the difference between a bias crime and the difference between that and violating somebody's civil rights, because there are also charges brought against people for violating civil rights. That's different than charging them with a bias crime, is it not?
Well, it could actually be overlapping. In fact, for example, the Massachusetts bias crime law is actually framed in terms of violating their civil rights under the Massachusetts Constitution. In federal law, there are multiple kinds of civil rights crimes. Bias crimes are one of them. Police officers using excessive force is a different kind because it's a violation of rights under color of law. So I would say civil rights crimes are more extensive than bias crimes. Maybe I'd say all bias crimes are civil rights crimes, not all civil rights crimes are bias crimes. You know, the idea that you've got federal jurisdiction over some of these cases also puts the full resources of the FBI behind many of these cases, because increasingly, particularly in the 21st century, many of these cases involve the use of the Internet and very sophisticated technologies where many state and local police forces are really beyond their capability of handling them fully, whereas the FBI has those kinds of resources. So it actually has allowed not just for federal prosecutions, but for federal investigations and cooperation between federal and state law enforcement on these cases. If I could just add a word about the deterrent issue that you asked about, it may well be that deterrence is a hard way to measure the efficacy of a criminal law, but one way that certainly is not is the impact that the law has on the overall society. You know, different kinds of crimes hurt people in different ways. The great Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes famously said, even a dog knows the difference between being tripped over and being kicked. If a dog knows the difference between being tripped over and kicked, how much more so does a person know the difference between an accidental or intentional crime, or an intentional crime because of where you happen to be and an intentional crime because of who you are?
410-662-8780 is our number here on Midday. We're talking about bias crimes and legislation intended to combat them. 410-662-8780. If you want to follow us on Twitter, our handle at Midday Tom Hall. If you want to drop us an email, our address is midday@wypr.org. Let's go to the phones. Jessica in York, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing? You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I have a question.
Uh-huh. And what is that?
I was wondering, in cases of domestic abuse or sexual assault, in which the perpetrator can be proven to be sexist or self-proclaimed a sexist, are they ever persecuted or prosecuted as being involved in a hate crime or a biased crime? And if they're not, why not?
Robert West, you want to take that one?
I have to be honest. That's not necessarily my area of expertise. I don't necessarily have the experience. I can't speak to specifically domestic issues and hate crimes.
All right, Frederick Lawrence, do you have any experience in that regard?
I do. Jessica,
question.
Jessica has raised an incredibly important question that has been raised in the area of bias crimes. When there are cases of gender-motivated violence, can they be prosecuted as bias crimes? The answer is, in many jurisdictions, yes. Sometimes when they are not prosecuted as bias crimes, it's because specific areas of the law has already picked that up for heightened focus. For example, at the most extreme level, crimes of rape or lesser crimes of sexual assault still have a heightened level of punishment and a great level of attention that law enforcement has given them. So to a certain extent, those have been dealt with otherwise. But if it can be proven that a victim was selected on the basis of gender, in other words, not who she is, but what she is, then in some jurisdictions that has been prosecuted as a bias crime.
And Robert West, in your work with the Missouri chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, give us an idea of the kinds of cases that you're bringing to the courts and the kinds of prosecutions that you all are getting involved in and the reasons for them.
Sure. So, you know, obviously hate crimes, along with all other kinds of crimes, are, you know, the result of police investigations, arrests, and, you know, in conjunction with prosecutors' offices. So, you know, we don't necessarily take an extremely active role in those sorts of situations, but what we do is, you know, the kinds of cases that are brought to our attention in which we seek, you know, the attention of the prosecutor's office or the police, you know, in a hate crime capacity is cases in which, you know, clients will come to us and they have been, you know, stalked or harassed or threatened or maybe even already physically attacked. And it's, you know, in the context of them also, you know, being victimized because of their religion as Muslims or their national origin as Arabs or South Asians or Bosnians or what have you. You know, if there is an element in which the suspect is victimizing one of our clients, and he's saying, he or she is saying things to them like, you know, I wish you guys would go back to your country, or you guys are destroying America, I don't like seeing you guys move into my street. You know, that sort of thing is what kind of tips us off. And when we announce the work that we are doing, or, you know, if we're working with the local authorities or what have you, we will then ask that the local authorities investigate the matter as if it is potentially a bias-related incident or a hate crime.
And Faizan Syed, it's interesting that the bedfellows that have come to jump in the bed together opposing hate crime or bias crime legislation are a very interesting mix. They range from the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, who are concerned that it's not punishing just actions, but it's punishing constitutionally protected free speech. They say that, you know, it simply should not be a crime to think or even to say hurtful statements. It's obviously a crime to commit violence against a person. But Mike Pence, when he was the governor of Indiana and also as a congressman, and many religious and conservative groups on the religious right oppose hate crime legislation because it singles out certain groups as protected classes. The ones that one of the groups that they're very concerned about is the LGBTQ community, because being an LGBTQ community member violates their notion of proper behavior and their what they would describe as freedom of religion. I mean, if someone says on religious grounds, because I'm a Christian and I believe that Jesus is the only way to get into heaven, therefore I oppose Muslims. How do you respond to that? And we've lost Mr. Syed one more time. Frederick Lawrence, what about that? I mean, part of what seems to be at the root of this is who is allowed to be a protected class, is it not? I mean, the law has to decide that particular communities that are drawn together for various reasons are singled out. And does that become a slippery slope?
I don't think it becomes a slippery slope. It is a very important social judgment to make, and you learn a lot about the roles of different groups in a multicultural society like ours when a society recognizes them as groups, given the history and given their role in society, that they ought to be included in a bias crime law, in a hate crime law. You know, the concern with punishing thought, it seems to me, although I understand where it's coming from, ultimately is misplaced. No one is being punished for thoughts and for thinking alone. People are being punished for a kind of crime that has a more serious harm on a victim. Take it out of the criminal context for a second. Put it in the civil context of an employment decision. You know, absent some provision in a contract or some union requirement, most people in this country are employees at will. They can be fired for any reason or no reason if the boss wants to fire them. But that same person can't be fired because of that person's race or religion or ethnicity. That's a violation of employment discrimination laws. The only thing that changes is what's in the state of mind of the boss in that case. But most people would accept that whereas at-will employees may be fired for no reason, you can't fire people for discriminatory reasons. Well, similarly, we take into account what's in the actor's mind if that's what motivates somebody to do a particular harm to the victim. If you're just thinking thoughts, writing articles, making speeches, there's no criminal activity at all, and that's completely protected.
And Faizan Syed, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can. I'm glad you're back with us, and sorry we keep losing you temporarily. About 2.5 years ago, there was a guy from Baltimore, a man named Ismail Brinsley, who went up to Brooklyn and approached a police car in the Bed-Stuy neighborhood of Brooklyn and killed two police officers, Wenjun Liu and Rafael Ramos. Should police officers be a protected class the way Muslims might be, or LGBTQ, or women, or African Americans? At what point do we draw the line at protecting particular groups of people, in your view? And once again, Mr. Syed seems to have dropped off the face of the earth, and I again apologize to everybody for not being able to keep him on the line. But Mr. Lawrence, could I put that question to you? I mean, are police
sure.
officers as a group a protected class under the law?
You know, I think one can imagine a situation where the historical context would be such the one would want to treat them that way. In reality, in most jurisdictions, crimes against police officers already are treated differently. For example, in those states that have death penalties, murder of a police officer, particularly in the line of duty, is considered an aggravating circumstance for imposition of the death penalty. In most jurisdictions, that's taken into account. Assault of a federal officer is a federal crime, even if you didn't know he was a federal officer. So there really are many protections that are built into that. And it seems to me it probably is extending the hate crime project in a not particularly helpful way.
And Mr. West, before we take a little break, is it a good idea for us to use the legal code, for us to use our system of laws to sort of outlaw hate, to outlaw the bad thoughts, to outlaw or make illegal thinking these things that are repugnant to most right-thinking individuals?
So I think that that's, you know, I think that it's easy to hear that question. And, you know, the first impulse answer is yes, because hate is bad and we should use whatever tools we have at our disposal, to minimize bad behavior and encourage good behavior, including our legal code, as you say. I think that, you know, the problem comes in terms of, you know, in practice, how does it actually play out in our justice system? You know, how we have this system of laws, but we also know that our justice system isn't perfect, and in practice, it leads sometimes to disparity of outcomes. Depending on statistically things such as class and race, and so you know, I guess the short answer is yes. The long answer is yes, but. You know, how does it look in practice, and how exactly, you know, are we making sure there are safeguards in place to protect people from those sorts of nuances?
Robert West is the civil rights attorney for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the Missouri chapter. He joins us this afternoon on the phone from St. Louis. Frederick Lawrence is a lawyer and a civil rights scholar. He's a former federal prosecutor. He's a senior research scholar and visiting professor of law now at the Yale Law School. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we invite you to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. If you want to follow us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Before we take a break, if you are a regular listener to our program, you know that every Monday we read the names of the people killed in the city of Baltimore during the previous week. We stand in sympathy with their families and friends. So far this year, 127 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week alone, 12 people were the victims of a homicide in our city. They are Carlos Montgomery, age 44, Channon Simpkins, age 28, Tony Tingle, age 31, Renesha Hunt, age 24, Terrell Carroll, age 39, DeAndre Johnson, age 25. Charles Gatuthu, age 35. Michael Duncan, age 37. Kwame Cheeks, age 29. DeAndre Coleman, age 19. A man who has yet to be identified by police who was 32 years old. And Vincent Curtis. He was 53. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we're talking about bias crime and bias crime legislation, and we're considering whether they're an effective means for preventing and prosecuting criminal acts that are motivated by bigotry. So what do you think? Do you think hate crime laws actually work? Do they deter bias-motivated violence? Do they make the usual targets of bias crimes, racial, ethnic, religious, and gender groups, do they make those folks feel any safer? And are hate crime laws enforced fairly and justly? Are bias crimes and their laws, are the bias crime laws redundant? How should bigots who commit crimes be treated differently from criminals who act without apparent racial or other bias? Let me know what you think. Give us a call at 410-662-8780. Send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Joining us from St. Louis is Robert West. He's with the Council on American Islamic Relations in the Missouri chapter of that organization. He serves as the civil rights attorney. And because I am a person of unlimited optimism, I'm going to tell you that we also have with us Faizan Saeed, who is the executive director of the Missouri chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. And Mr. Saeed, do we actually have you again?
Yes, I believe so.
There we go. They sound much better than the last time we tried talking to you. Joining us as well from New York, Frederick Lawrence. He's a former federal prosecutor and the former president of Brandeis University. He's currently a senior research scholar and visiting professor of law at the Yale Law School. Again, our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Faizan Saeed, there are folks who say that the laws, these bias crime laws, are actually in some cases disproportionately used against poor people and people of color, who are obviously one of the protected groups that the law is meant to help. What's your response to that contention?
I can't speak to the specifics about that, but I know at least within the case that we deal with, primarily the people that these laws are used against are often white males who target Islamic centers or American Muslims for various reasons. Even the last year, we've seen a 57% increase in anti-Muslim bias incidents and a 44% increase in actual hate crime. The vast majority of those were done by, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, by young white men.
And Mr. Lawrence, do you know anything about that data? I mean, one of the people, one of the organizations that cites that data is the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. They do not support bias crime legislation. They work generally supporting the rights of the LGBTQ community. There's another group called Queers for Economic Justice. They also oppose bias crime legislation. Can you speak to that particular contention that the people that the law is intended to help actually are disproportionately singled out when it comes to prosecuting?
I think that, in fact, has not been the case, that, in fact, particularly with respect to the LGBTQ community, those laws have been used perhaps not sufficiently to protect that community, but not in a way that has adversely affected that community. So that does strike me as an unusual perspective that they have. And with respect to the other cases, there certainly are issues of bias crimes that involve people of color as the defendants, not just as the victims, as you would expect in any other crime. But I do think that those investigations have taken place based on the instances of the crimes, and there's been very little to suggest, as it were, bias motivation in the implementation and execution of bias crime laws.
And Mr. Lawrence, you wrote an essay that was published on the MSNBC website after the horrible shooting in Orlando at the Pulse nightclub, which was originally reported as a terrorist attack, and then it was later reported as a bias crime against the LGBTQ community. So you make the point in that essay, and you've made it just this afternoon in our conversation, that it's not just the effect on the individual who is targeted for the crime, but the entire community in terms of the psychological trauma that an entire community, in this case the LGBTQ community, would suffer. What is the difference then between that and people who live in a high crime neighborhood? If there's just a lot of crime, if there's a crime wave always going on, we have people living in very economically distressed neighborhoods here in Baltimore and in cities across the country in which murders and assaults and robberies and sexual assaults are commonplace, I mean, much more commonplace than in the so-called safer neighborhoods and other areas of our city. I mean, if you're living in constant fear, because you happen to live in a geographic location that has a history of violent crime, what's the difference between that and living in constant fear because you're a gay man in Orlando, Florida?
I think in all of these cases, the victims and the victim community deserves and receives great sympathy from the society. So in no case is any one of these cases not being taken seriously. I think what is different in the case of, for example, the Pulse nightclub, is that you see the impact not just on the actual target victims, the people in the nightclub, but well beyond, and not just in the area, the people who feel as if they themselves were targeted, they themselves were victimized. And you see this in terms of the psychological patterns of what we call victimology that people exhibit, a sense of higher incidence of depression, higher incidence of hypertension, a sense of separation from society. You don't just see this for people who are specifically there, but in the broader community, because they view it as an attack on the entire community. That's how it's intended, and that's how it's perceived.
And Faizan Syed, in St. Louis, when you encounter this uptick in, as you have been encountering this uptick in bias crimes in these last several months, do you attribute any of that to the presidential campaign that we had between now President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton? People point to that as a very, very divisive and sort of, you know, hateful time in terms of the campaign rhetoric, particularly from the Trump campaign.
Right. So even just to add on to that, there are many people in America that have biases against people of other faith, religion, ethnicity, sexual orientations. But when you have somebody who's running for the highest office in the land, who's then also exhibiting the same behavior and using similar rhetoric that empowers and emboldens many of these people who have these biases to then perhaps act on their biases, which is why in the last several months we've seen a sharp increase in at least anti-Muslim hate incidents and crimes, whether it's the vandalism of Islamic centers, whether it's people who wear the hijab, the Muslim head covering in public, being targeted, and so much more. So it definitely has an empowering effect. Another question you had asked earlier about whether hate crime legislation or bias legislation is effective as a deterrent. It may not be as effective as a deterrent for all the reasons mentioned before, but what would be effective is when especially elected officials stand up against this type of hatred and rhetoric. I was here in St. Louis when Vice President Mike Pence came to the University City Jewish Cemetery, and part of his speech was to denounce and speak against anti-Semitism and the desecration of that cemetery. Of course, he didn't mention anti-Muslim bias, which his administration are in many ways actively promoting, and whether they like it or not, are helping to contribute to anti-Muslim attacks that are happening all across the country. Not only Muslim attacks, but also against Hispanics and other people as well.
And Mr. Lawrence, there have been a number of court cases concerning freedom of speech issues that revolve around this topic of bias crimes. I mean, very famously, a bunch of neo-Nazis and Klansmen marched through Skokie, Illinois, a community that had as residents many people that had survived the Holocaust. And the court ruled, and you certainly know a lot more about this than I do, but the court ruled that they, in fact, were allowed to march. Now, if they had gone up on people's doorsteps and started banging the doors down and committing violent acts, they obviously wouldn't have been allowed to do that. But would you think that there are people in Skokie and people around the country when that incident happened, and many similar incidents have happened since then, that the mere presence on the street is an act of hate? I mean, if you're a Klansman and you're walking down the streets of Atlanta or Phoenix or Detroit, that in alone by itself is an act of bias. What do you think about that?
I think that by itself is an act of bias, and you're allowed to do that in a free society. Part of the price of living in a free society is that we are exposed to many views that we find objectionable and some that we even find abhorrent. The point is, when does that cross over into something that is more serious than that, that is properly cognizable of the criminal law? I'll give you a good example from another Supreme Court case, Tom. This was in the early 2000s, called Virginia against Black. It was two cases that came up testing the constitutionality of the Virginia cross-burning statute. And the court wound up upholding one and striking down the other, and you'll see the point here right away. In one case, a cross was burned on the lawn of an African-American family, clearly designed to terrorize them. It was part of an ongoing fight between neighbors, and it was a graphic manifestation of bigotry, and that was called a hate crime. In the other case, it was a Klan rally where they burned a cross at the end of a Klan rally. That was held to be protected. Now, clearly, what is evidenced by burning a cross at a Klan rally is all of the racial bigotry that we've been talking about. But that's expressing it, which is protected by the First Amendment, as opposed to acting on it, which can be punished.
Robert West, who's joining us from St. Louis with the Missouri chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. If we take, for example, the case of Dylan Roof in South Carolina, here's a kid who's dropped out of high school in the ninth grade, trolled the internet, and became a virulent racist. He was convicted of 33 counts of federal hate crimes for killing the nine Black parishioners at that church in South Carolina. The verdict came back quickly. Nobody disagreed. He's shown no remorse. He's a horrible human being, but he would have gotten the death penalty for each count of murder that he committed that afternoon that evening at Mother Emanuel Church. Anyway, I mean, is the fact that he was convicted of hate crime legislation, how does that make it better?
I think there's a strong argument to be made that it makes it better from the standpoint of what you and Mr. Lawrence were talking about more in the first segment of the show, when Mr. Lawrence pointed out that an important component in the thought behind hate crime legislation is the societal value it has. I think that the African American community, where that really horrendous attack occurred, I think that there are members of that community there, and maybe even across the entire country, who feel targeted, by that attack. They feel affected by it.
All right, well, we are going to have to call it there for the end of our conversation, but I appreciate it to all three of you for joining us this afternoon. Robert West and Faizan Syed are from the Missouri chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Frederick Lawrence has been with us from New York. He's the past president of Brandeis University and currently a scholar and visiting professor at the Yale School of Law. That's it for us today. I'd like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Coming up on midday tomorrow, I'll talk to director Ryan White. He's got a new Netflix documentary called The Keepers about a murder that occurred of a nun at Archbishop Keough High School back in the 60s and 70s. We'll speak with Mr. White tomorrow here on midday. Stay tuned now for Here and Now. It's coming right up after the news. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.